Welcome to the Solid Faith Podcast. My guest today is Hillary Ferrer. She, along with several other contributors, have put together a book called Mama Bear Apologetics. And in that book, they explore a lot of the tough topics that parents are trying to address today. Everything from our belief in God, our faith in God, to emotionalism, feminism, Marxism, progressive Christianity. And I just want to give you a warning if you are a parent, some of the things that we talk about may be a little bit disturbing. We talk about some of the things that are being put into our educational institutions as well. So it may not be appropriate for younger children to listen to, but we want to thank you for listening to this podcast. And I really urge you, if you're a parent, if you are a youth leader, if you are leading young people in any capacity, to give this a listen. And we appreciate it. And thank you in advance.
First shot, I'ma kill it, never remain calm. Clever with the lyrics, been fire dragon for Mulan. Fit for all this rapping, just need a stage to put shoes on. This is just a rehearsal and not the main song. Lyrics raining, the wind is blowing the dang palms. I've been looking for something for me to go and bang on. Looking like I'm
My guest today is Hillary Ferrer. Hillary has her master's in biology, is that correct?
That is correct.
She's the founder of Mama Bear Apologetics. We're going to talk a little bit about her book. And she's also the vice president of Women in Apologetics. So how you doing, Hillary? Tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, all that good stuff.
Yeah, I'm doing great. So my background in apologetics is I was introduced to it when I was 12. And so this is one of the reasons I am so passionate about introducing youth to apologetics, because I can truly say that apologetics probably just changed my life in the sense that it gave me this foundation for faith, where it wasn't just having blind belief and believing what your parents told you. When I was 12, my pastor went through a series on, he started with the Liar Lord Lunatic series, kind of that trilemma, which kind of is a quadrilemma now with, I don't know if that's the correct phrase, but with legend now would probably be the fourth one added in there. So he went through C.S. Lewis's thing on that. He went through reliability of the New Testament documents, and he went through the case for the resurrection. And I remember sitting there just scribbling notes as fast as I could, just thinking, this is different than any sermon I've ever heard. This is something I can actually talk to people about. I'd always had a hard time talking about my faith because, you know, I was raised in a Christian church. I didn't know what it was like to be a non-Christian, so I didn't know what to say to non-Christians. But this was something I could have a conversation with somebody about. So I really just fell in love with it then, and wrote papers on it for classes when I was in high school. And I kind of got away from it for a while, just when I was in the arts. I was a photographer for 10 years, and it wasn't until I met my husband that he started rekindling that love. And so for the longest time, I was thinking, oh, you know, I'll just be the woman behind the scenes with his ministry, until he kept encouraging me, no, you need to do something. And so I kind of felt the Lord calling me towards Mama Bear, and never expected it. Always said I'd never start a ministry, and yet here we are.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I like too about, you know, just reading off your resume. You, what you're doing with Women in Apologetics is just phenomenal. So it's interesting that you say, like, hey, you know, I thought I was going to be in the background, and now, you know, I'm writing my own books, I'm doing my own thing. It's really neat, and so I love what you guys are doing with Women in Apologetics. You don't see enough, or in the past we haven't seen enough, in my opinion, women on the forefront. And so it's neat to see a group of women who are doing apologetics and really heading it up. And the events that you guys do, I think you do something annually, is that correct?
Yeah, we have an annual conference. It's going to be coming up in January 24th and 25th of 2020, and it's going to be hosted by Biola out in La Mirada, California. So I'll be keynoting on some of the topics from the Mama Bear book there. And we have a really good lineup this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's neat. I saw a little bit of the lineup, and I noticed that you guys had some pretty big people on there. And so, I think that's going to be a great conference, and I love what you guys are doing with Women in Apologetics. I think it's a phenomenal ministry, and so totally
Thank
support
you.
That. Yeah, absolutely. So as I was reading your book, you know, Mama Bear Apologetics, and, you know, I've gotten a lot of feedback from people who I said, hey, we're interviewing someone who's going to tell you some things about, you know, being a mama bear and protecting your kids. And even some of my friends were laughing, because here I am reading Mama Bear Apologetics, and obviously I'm not a mom. Of course I'm not a mom. So I guess that's my first question is, do you have to be a mom to be a mama bear?
Apparently, you don't even have to be a mom to lead a mama bear group, because we actually have a guy. We have a guy leading a mama bear group. We have a single guy that's not married, doesn't have kids, that was part of the launch team. And I myself don't have children. So I think anyone that really has a passion for youth can be a mama bear or a papa bear. I always like to say on the mama bear stuff that mama bear is for mothers of biological, adopted, foster, or spiritual children. Because the concept of having spiritual children isn't something we invented. That was something that, you know, you talk about with Abraham in the Old Testament, your descendants will be as numerous as the sky. And it wasn't just talking about his physical descendants, but also the spiritual children he would have through that covenant of faith. I think that when people start realizing what's going on with youth, grab a kid that needs to be mentored, that needs to have questions answered, that just wants to have conversations. And in my case, when I felt the Lord calling me to start Mama Bear, first off, I've never done anything in women's ministry, like at all. Never done a single Beth Moore Bible study. Like, it was the idea of even doing women in apologetics was odd to me. I'm like, why do we need a whole society for this? Until it was brought to my attention that there's a whole demographic of women who won't read something unless it's written by a woman for a woman. And when I found that out, it like opened my eyes to this. Wow, this is an untapped demographic that we really need to pour into. And then for the moms, I kind of felt the Lord saying when he was kind of pushing me to start this ministry, it was, I don't really consider it my idea. It was more like a bunch of sleepless nights with ideas that I kept writing down so that I could try to get to sleep. And it ended up like kind of outlining the whole ministry. And I kind of prayed a prayer, sort of like I assume that Moses prayed. Not that I'm not comparing myself to Moses here, but he said, you know, why are you sending me? Who am I? I thought, I'm not a mom, so nobody's going to listen to me. They're all going to be like, oh, you know, what does she know? I have yet to have someone say that, but I really felt like the Lord was saying, if you can equip other moms, that basically I have time. I have something that a lot of moms don't have, which is time to research. And if I can use that time to help equip the moms out there, then I have been the best mom that I can be.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm what you might call, Hillary, a mama's boy. I have a mom who's very protective, and I tend to think, I have two brothers, but I tend to think I'm her favorite one. I don't really think it's even close. But she's very protective, and if you want to see a mom come alive, you mess with her kids, and, you know, all of a sudden, this little small woman becomes a monster, a ferocious
force to be reckoned with.
That's right. So I think what you guys are doing is incredible, because, you know, we have people that are even listening to this podcast that they don't know what you mean when you say the word apologetics. They don't totally have that, and they're like, why do I need to study these ideas? And I love the subtitle of your first chapter. It says, you know, my kid has a Cheerio stuck up his nose. Why am I reading this chapter? And it's just hilarious, but it's really good because you guys are engaging Christian apologetics. You're giving moms the tools to defend their kids from bad ideas that are being spread in our culture, and also to empower them with good ideas, you know, with the healthy approach. And so I wonder if you want to, you know, kind of expound on that a little bit, but how do you approach, you know, people have so many differing viewpoints. How do you approach someone whose viewpoint comes in direct conflict with your own? And how do you empower your kids or the next generation? Or, you know, if you're just empowering young people, you're leading in youth ministry, whatever, to attack these ideas, but to offer healthy ideas and to respond to the ideas in our culture that are, you know, totally against God.
Yeah. So first off, fun fact, I got a text from one of my mama bears, Amanda, I think it was Amanda Burke. Maybe I shouldn't tell whose son it is. She sent me a picture of her son in the emergency room, and it said, he doesn't have a Cheerio up his nose, but he's got a whole lot of Play-Doh. And so, like, the whole Cheerio up the nose started out as a joke in one of our Skype sessions. But this is, like, a real thing moms have to deal with, is especially if they have boys, they shove stuff up their nose. Right. And so when you have stuff like that going on, it's like, how can I get to all these other things? But your question is, how do we raise our children to do this, especially with differing viewpoints from our own? Is I think we can both agree that our society has sort of lost the ability to dialogue on a massive scale. And so we are really, there's a couple things that we're really strong with in this book, that we talk about discernment. Like, what do we mean by discernment? And by discernment, we're meaning that we're not just going to go and pick apart and say, this is everything wrong with this idea. I think that really, that's not very respectful, first, of other people. And I kind of have a phrase in there that says, do you want to be heard or do you want to be understood and persuasive? Because a clanging gong is heard, but it's not understood and persuasive. And so one of the things that we do with discernment is we say, what is the good idea this person is espousing? So usually they have something that they have recognized, like, who is it? Kingdom of the Cults. Oh, golly, who wrote that? Anyway, he said, the cults are the church's unpaid bills. And so I think it's not just for cults. I would say this is with bad ideologies, that when someone holds a bad ideology, a lot of times it's from the church's unpaid bill. There's something that church has been neglecting that they're trying to address, but they're addressing it in a worldly way. So if we teach our kids to recognize what is the good that they're trying to address, now let's look at what are some of the lies that have snuck in from worldly thinking. And then, so this is actually going through the ROAR method, starts with recognize the message, basically what are people saying. Offer discernment is the recognize the good, identify the good, identify the bad. And then the A for argue for a healthier approach, we're saying, okay, the good that you and I just agreed on, that we built trust on, that we built a bridge on, how does the Christian worldview actually address that issue in a better way? That way we're still standing on the same ground. We might be fighting for this common good in different ways, but this is how I think scripture actually addresses it better. And then the final R, reinforce through discussion, discipleship, and prayer. So it's going through with your kids. This is how we look at ideas. This is how we affirm the good. This is how we reject the bad. This is how we build common ground. And then show them how the Christian worldview does address whatever it is that they're concerned about.
Right. You know, you brought up your chapter on discernment, and I think it's such a good chapter because, you know, one of the things that you point out in the chapter is, if we just label everything as this is good, this is bad, what's going to happen is the kids that are, they see something in the media or something that you've labeled as bad or entirely wrong, and they see some truth in there or some good thing in there, and then they start to distrust the people who have told them this is absolutely bad, you are not allowed to touch this, you know, stay away from this, and they see truth, and the vice versa, because they can see something that you said is, this is Christian, it's got a Christian label on it, it's totally good, and then all of a sudden they see something that's a lie or that's absolutely wrong, and they quit trusting the things that we label as Christian and worldly, instead of just discerning the message.
You know, I think when you classify things as either all safe or all dangerous, you end up either rejecting a truth or swallowing a lie. And both of those are what we're trying to get our kids to avoid. And this concept of there being an autopilot in Christianity, like if I can just categorize something correctly, then I don't have to think about it. I think of especially so like the book Rules for Radicals, which I read through for the Marxism chapter. And there's a quote in there. One of the rules is that whatever you're doing, you have to cloak it in moral language. And so that's one of the things that we're seeing in society right now is all sorts of unbiblical agendas being cloaked in moral language. And since Christianity is inherently moral, they're going to be using the concept. And this is where the linguistic theft comes from, the chapter four. They're using Christian words and Christian lingo, the concept of justice and love and oppression and all these things that we're supposed to either be for or against, and changing the definition to what the world says that means. And then foisting it out on our kids and saying, this is what your Bible teaches. Why aren't you following it? And the kids are going, I don't know what to do with this, because they haven't properly defined those concepts.
Right. This is one of the reasons I like your website. I think I would recommend anybody who enjoys this conversation to go to your website, mamabearapologetics.com. Is that right?
That's correct. And it's spelled M-A-M-A. A lot of people spell it different ways. So I like to be clear. That's how to spell it.
Good point. So that's how they can go and find. You write articles on this on a regular basis. You have several contributors, I'm sure. But I've seen a lot of your articles. And, like a word like unity, sounds really good.
Sounds right? So good, doesn't it?
It sounds great. And you hear these big, nice words. And one of the things that you pointed out in an article I read is, okay, it's important to ask, what are you unifying around? Because, mm-hmm. you know, asking the right questions is just as important as giving kids the right answers and the next generation the right answers.
Absolutely. My dad taught me that. He always told me, you don't need to know all the answers. You just need to know how to ask the right questions and where to find the answers. And that's what we're kind of trying to help equip moms to do is learn how to think through these things so they can help their kids think through them. And it's not just dumping a bunch of answers on them that's like extra stuff you need to memorize. It's like, how do you think through these things?
Right. Yeah. Now, I know you mentioned this a second ago, and I don't know if you want to expound on it anymore, but the Roar method, I think it's really easy to remember. If you're a mama bear, you remember you got to roar. You know, you have
right.
to.
Hashtag roar like a mother.
That's right. That's right. And just to recap, recognizing the message, offering discernment, arguing for a healthier approach, and then reinforcing through discussion, discipleship, and prayer. So I don't know if you want to expound on that just a little more on how that, what that looks like, using the Roar method to, I guess, address or respond to some of the cultural lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we started out when we first did this with the six D's, and it was like detect, discern, all these things. And then nobody could remember them. And we're like, if we can't remember them, no one else is going to remember them. So it was actually Julie Loos, amazing lady. She's so good with acronyms, but she's the one that helped us with, all our prayers. And so she kind of helped come up, we crafted this together. It took us a while to really get it. But, so yeah, I think probably one of the hardest ones in there is really recognizing the message, because I think one of the things that slips in so unnoticed is really understanding what the message is. And again, because if we take it back to that Rules for Radicals quote, if it's cloaked in moral language, you're not actually hearing the actual message, because they're changing the language there. They're telling you how they want you to interpret it, not the actual message that's being said. So it's being able to kind of look past what's being said and saying, okay, what's actually being said here? Right. So that recognize the message is important. The offer discernment, the thing I always wanted to affirm that is you have to acknowledge the good first. And we're very clear about that in the book. You have to acknowledge the good first. If you just start picking apart someone's worldview, they're just going to tune you out as another, you know, clucking chicken that's trying to tell them everything wrong in the world. And I call that the stench of self-righteousness and not the aroma of Christ. So let's give some examples of things that we can affirm. So some of the emotionalism chapter. Are there good things we can affirm in emotions? And the answer is yes, that emotions can point us to truth, but they have to be disciplined by reason, scripture, and reality. That if you take those three things out of your emotions, who knows where that's going to lead you? Or the Marxism chapter, when I was, you know, doing the chew and spit method in chapter 3, I believe, I think I referenced the Marxism chapter that when I read the Communist Manifesto, I thought, you know what? He made some legitimate points in here. He made some legitimate critiques. And this is something we can stand together on and say, I agree with you on that. For example, of having children in the workforce for crazy, crazy hours. So child labor was an issue. The hypocrisy that was going on within the upper class. Some of the things where like someone would be working for a factory and they get their arm, you know, cut off and then they just get fired with nothing. Stuff like that were legitimate wrongs that Marx was able to identify. And so that would be, okay, let's look at the things. That's probably the stuff that a Marxist is looking at, or someone who's a social justice warrior is looking at legitimate wrongs that are being done. So, but the phrase Marxism and the phrase social justice carries so much baggage with them. That we want to just completely poo-poo it without listening to what critiques the people are leveling that they think are really important. And I think we would be surprised at how many things we can agree with on that. So for the offer discernment, that finding what you agree with first is the most important step, because it says, I hear you, I understand you, and you don't need to shout louder to get me to hear, because I'm affirming the same things that you're affirming. But then you start identifying the lies that are in there, which is also part of discernment, the lies that have snuck in. And then, like I said before, the argue for a healthier approach. How does scripture address this in a better way? And I think that a lot of times you can, you're to say that it addresses it in a better way is, I would say, it's addressing not just the immediate need, but it's looking down the road. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times misplaced compassion addresses an immediate need without looking down the road. And that can actually put people in a worse scenario. But I think scripture is really good about anticipating things. And in that sense, I think it's a useful study for how to conduct society.
Right. Yeah. You know, we had Dr. David Geisler, Norman Geisler's son. We had him on the program, and he talked about, you know, one of the first things he's trying to do in conversational evangelism when he's trying to reach someone who differs than him from him ideologically. He will try to kind of decrease their defense or eliminate their defense. And I feel like mm-hmm. that's a big part of this. It's bringing the defensive walls down. We know yes. With Thanksgiving approaching, there's going to be arguments at the table about politics. There's going to be, you know, but to bring the walls down first and talk about things we agree on, and then to try to build on those things is a big part of what you are, you know, kind of hitting at here. And I think that's really important. I like this book because you guys cover more than just, you know, a lot of apologetics books will give you the arguments for God. They mm-hmm. will give you the basics of apologetics. And yet I've actually been recommending this book to a lot of people who are just starting in apologetics because it touches these social issues that mm-hmm. so many people seem to care so much about, almost more than the arguments for God's existence. And so I think it's great because you do touch on good arguments for God's existence, but you also go into these social issues, which I feel like that's where the most tension is, right? Those are the conversations we don't want to have at the dinner yes. table, but you mm-hmm. know they're coming with Thanksgiving, with Christmas coming on. There are family members that you know you're going to sit across the table from, and it's going to get heated. And I have family members who, you know, we get into those discussions, and I have a little bit of fun with it. I kind of enjoy it a little too much, but
I'm sure they expect it from you now, so right? It's all good.
That's right. So anyway, I like this book as someone who is new to this. If you're new to this, it's not one of those that you can't handle. Mm-hmm. You know, when I tell other parents about this book, a lot of them are shocked that there's a chapter on Marxism, and I think that shows. It shows the I'm very aware of Marxism, you know, as a young person. You know, I see how these messages are embedded into my society, my generation. But some mm-hmm. parents, I think, are a little disconnected. They can't believe that we're actually talking about this. But it's there.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, fun fact with the Marxism, that was the chapter that we actually didn't plan on. It was in studying emotionalism and studying mm-hmm. feminism and some of the progressive Christianity that the Marxism, it became so obvious that we couldn't leave this one out, that we actually had to scrap another chapter in order to make room for this one, because the tentacles of it are going through wow. so many different ideas that I thought, holy cow, we can't ignore this. That would be almost, irresponsible for this book.
Right. Yeah. You know, I wonder, Hillary, if you would unpack a little bit. You just talked about, you know, feminism, progressive Christianity, emotionalism, all these isms, I guess.
Yes.
But if you would unpack progressive Christianity for us, and I think maybe we could walk through feminism as well, because, you know, feminism for women to be writing a chapter on feminism and giving you their perspective, I thought was just unique. So why don't we start there? Let's start with feminism.
Okay.
And you know, if you just give me a little bit of about what you cover and, you know, kind of your central idea. But one thing I loved in the chapter, your book is just so it's filled with humor. I mean, I was laughing. It was so funny to read. There was and now I'm going to butcher the actual, I'm paraphrasing, but there were two men telling the writer, I don't remember who
yes.
exactly wrote the feminist chapter. They were tweeting to her that she did not need to be saying these things. So how ironic is that?
Oh, yeah. Elisa got mansplained on feminism. It was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was pretty funny reading that. Like, here's two men trying to silence a woman who is, you know, expressing her thoughts on feminism. So let's get into so I had a question for you, and this will kind of tie into all that. It might seem on the surface that we're fighting a political battle. You got all these people that, you know, go into the category, I'm a Republican, conservative, liberal, Democrat, and those are our identities, and we buy into that, and we bleed that. But I get the sense, and you can expound on this, that the problem is not a political battle. It's not just politics. There's something going on under the surface of all these yes. things that we're talking about. So maybe you could expound on what's under the surface of all these issues.
So that's interesting you asked that. There's two things that we kind of felt were a running theme throughout a lot of these isms. And that's the concept of idolatry and the concept of original sin. So basically, I mean, those are some of your fundamental worldview issues of what went wrong with the world and how do we fix it? So what went wrong with the world is going to be your original sin. It's the thing that everything is reduced to this one problem. And then the concept of how do we fix it, that's idolatry of putting something ahead of God. So basically, almost every single chapter I could go through what do they define as original sin and what do they define as basically going to be our savior. So if we're going to be talking about feminism, feminism started out really, really good in the sense that it was just allowing women to basically fulfill their calling in business and in education and really upholding. I mean, if you look at the first like really good example of a woman going to seminary, and that's Mary sitting at Jesus's feet, because sitting at the feet of a teacher was considered to be one of the disciples, which was unheard of to let a woman sit at your feet. And so I would say Jesus was very feminist in the first wave feminism, that he was very pro educating women. He was very pro elevating them to this status of worth that had been lost in the ancient Near East. So I would say within feminism, our original sin has turned into the patriarchy. The patriarchy is the evil thing. It's the man keeping us down. And if we can just get rid of the patriarchy, well, you know, everything is going to be fine. You know, toxic masculinity, the future is female. This is our problem, that if we can solve this problem, everything's going to be utopia. So in that sense, feminism replaces just not even, I don't even see feminists looking nowadays, the current feminists, I don't see them trying to level the playing field. I see them trying to elevate women. Like, you're never going to see a t-shirt that says boy power. You will see girl power everywhere though. And so I would say that would be the theme with original sin and idolatry and feminism. I would say with Marxism, the original sin is capitalism, that all the ills of society can be traced back to capitalism. And if we can just get rid of capitalism and install this socialist utopia, all these problems are going to go away. And the same thing with progressive Christianity. I think they have made original sin is the idea of certainty, of that we can really feel be certain about any kind of convictions, which is interesting because they're very certain about their convictions that there's no certainty. It's one of those self-defeating statements. And then the savior for progressive Christianity is asking questions. Don't come to answers. It reminds me of that verse that talks about people always looking for knowledge, but never coming to always seeking knowledge, but never coming to the knowledge of the truth. The idea of asking questions is paramount and takes preference over any concept of having answers. And so I could go on with all these other isms, but there is original sin, and then there is, you know, the thing that's going to save you from that. And I would the idolatry, and that's a big thing.
Right. And, you know, these are Christian ideas. So we're kind of in this place where we're saying, hey, you know, this is a symptom of idolatry. It's a symptom of original sin. And yet the culture would say, well, you know, you just believe that because you're a Christian. And yeah. And they don't really see the logic or the reason behind that. And to me, that's where apologetics begins to really take its place is, but yes, we're Christians, but we also have good reasons to be Christians. You know, it's not just that we are just living this way because we've always have, or, you know, I was born in this demographic. I hear that all the time. You know, well, you were born, I live in Louisiana, so you're in the Bible Belt, and your parents are believers, and so you are too, and that's how... But I've really given some thought to my faith, as I'm sure you have, and every apologist has, stopping and giving thought to your faith and why you do the things you do, and of course that leads us gives us a good foundation to address these social issues. And I think there are a lot of parents who are looking for that. They're looking for that foundation. They're looking for that truth foundation. You have an amazing quote. You and I kind of talked a little before the podcast about this quote. It's neat. It says, when our society messes with the definition of truth, it's messing with our kids' very foundation of reality. If our children no longer feel comfortable using reality as their arbiter of truth, they'll be insecure and timid about having any convictions whatsoever. Could you expound on that quote a little bit?
Yes, and this is one of the things that I see. This is especially within emotionalism. It's within postmodernism, and it's really coming in, as Nancy Piercy expounded in the Love Thy Body, it's really coming in with the transgender movement of this idea that truth and reality are actually separate. That reality is basically been defined as what's in my head. And so if truth and reality are kind of the same thing, then what's in my head is truth. And so the stronger, you know, for emotionalism, the stronger I feel about something, the more true it is. And if I need to convince someone else that it's true, I need to whip them into an emotional frenzy so that they're basically their heart will tell them, oh, yes, that's true. But it's not being disciplined by scripture, reason, or reality. So, for example, this is one of the things that I point out in the, which chapter is that? In the emotionalism chapter, is this idea of emotions are meant to be followers and not leaders. So emotions can tell you things if they're already disciplined. But what we're doing is I'm feeling an emotion and then I'm looking for the culprit. So, for example, no longer are some of the, like the what's the phrase, sexual harassment. No longer is sexual harassment the subjective thing of someone doing or saying something. Sexual harassment has been redefined as how the woman felt, no matter what the guy actually did. So if a man patted her on the back when she was crying and that made her feel uncomfortable, then that was some kind of harassment. Instead of that was a misunderstanding, he was trying to make you feel better. He wasn't trying to, you know, cop a feel while you're crying. He was legitimately patting you on the back. Or the idea of someone feeling offended, and that feeling of offense means that someone objectively did something that was offensive. Instead of the way it's supposed to work is someone does something objectively offensive and then I feel offended. They're taking the feelings as the leaders that then determine the reality of the situation. And if we can't take the reality of the situation to define what reality is, that's going to be really confusing for our kids, especially going through, I'm going through a curriculum called the Genderbread curriculum on the Mama Bear blog. And it's talking about this idea that we can't even use our bodies to determine who we were created to be. It's all about this subjective experience in our heads. And then we have to change reality, literally cut off body parts in order to match that experience in our heads. And kids are being taught reality is not the arbiter of truth anymore. And so if it can change in their head at any time, why would they have any convictions? Because their emotions are going to change. I mean, anyone who's had teenagers knows how often their emotions change. Anyone who's lived with a woman knows how often their emotions can change. If we're using that as our standard of truth, why should I have convictions? Because I might change my mind tomorrow. I might feel differently tomorrow.
Right. It's amazing you bring up these points. I know Christians are labeled anti-science. You study biology. You know that there are biological differences between a male and a female. And there are people who will absolutely outright deny that, and then in the same breath accuse Christians of being anti-science, which is amazing to me.
Just talking about John with this about this today. That's funny. I remember when I was working on my final research, and one of the things that I noticed in some of the things that I was studying is that there were even gender differences in the rats. I'm trying to remember, I think it was, I was studying epigenetics and basically how some of the things that the parent rat can do that will affect the pup. And it was male rats, responding to, it was kind of a messed up, study, but it was like either cocaine or alcohol addiction. And it depended on which parent it came from as how it affected them and versus how it affected the female rat. Wow. And so I was thinking, good grief, even in the rat kingdom here, that we have, there's gender differences in how they physiologically respond to things. And so, yeah, when you say for the anti-science, a lot of times it It's not that we're trying to tell people who their identity is. It's that when you get on that operating table and they're about to give you anesthesia, they need to know certain things about how your body metabolizes that is controlled by your DNA that cannot be changed with hormones.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, we are in a time that I it's kind of hard to believe that people are requesting that the medication they receive, the medical treatment they receive, be based on how they feel and not biology and not real scientific research or real scientific fact. And you had a great quote in your emotionalism chapter. I can't let it pass me up. You said, when our society messes with the definition of truth, it's messing. Oh, we said this one. You said in your emotionalism chapter, too many people today determine truth by their emotions, yet they have not bothered to magnetize their emotional compass. So they'll say, let's go north, and they proceed to walk in all different directions, trying to convince everyone else to follow them. Instead of disciplining their emotions to match reality, they are trying to make the reality match their emotions. That's a great way to put it. I mean, that's where we're at, where we want to make reality match how I feel versus how I feel match reality. And honestly, the only way to be successful in anything in life is to measure up to an objective standard of truth and to really seek after what's real and not to just buy into just pure emotions. And I think, as you point out, there's good things in emotions, but here's the danger. You know?
Mm-hmm. And I would say, even like with what you were saying, what is the good that we can affirm? Like, the Kingdom of the Colts. Golly, why can't I remember his name? I've quoted him so many times. I feel it's Walter or something. This idea that, so I was going, what are the unpaid bills that we're seeing here? And I think really rigid gender stereotypes is actually one of those unpaid bills. This idea that we as a society have kind of created additional things to masculinity and femininity and then tried to hold people to that. And I think we can learn from the concept of not gender fluidity, but there is a fluidity and expression of gender. And so like when I was younger, good grief, I'm so glad I'm not growing up right now. When I was younger, I felt more comfortable with the guys. I liked hanging out with the guys. A lot of times I kind of wore clothes that were more kind of guyish, flannel and jeans and stuff like that. Never for a second did I question if I was a woman. And so I just considered, I think I was trying to separate myself from some of the unhealthy femininity. In my mind, I saw femininity as linked with irrational, which I don't think was a very healthy perspective. And since I've been married, I've been able to really, really change that and embrace a lot of the feminine aspects that I rejected when I was younger. Mm. But there was still, and I was still feminine in my own way. Back then, it was just expressed in a different way. I've always been interested in the big ideas and talking about things in science and thinking and things that maybe some of my girlfriends weren't as interested in. Now, if we put that into a rigid gender stereotype nowadays, I would say I feel it more like a guy. And that's not the case. I never had to question that. But now our kids are having to question that. But the good we can affirm, getting back to the point, the good we can affirm is we do want to say it's okay for our little boys to be dancers. It's okay for our little girls to want to go into the military. These things are not set in stone as biblical examples of masculinity and femininity. So that's something I think we can learn from.
Right. Yeah. You know, when I was a teenager, my parents had to deal with me going through the skater punk stage. I picked up a skateboard and I went through it.
It made it all the way to Louisiana, huh?
Yeah, it made it. Somehow it made it here. But, you know, even in Louisiana, man, I didn't really fit in. I'll just say that, you know, especially my hometown. But super skinny jeans. At one point I grew my hair really long, was straightening my hair. My parents put up with that. They didn't question, too much of what was going on there, because they knew that at the heart of things, I knew the good in things. I've been exposed to truth. I've been taught truth. And never did I really change. I always, stayed faithful as far as my belief in God. And, I was able to be around people who thought totally different than I did about religious things or even political issues. And I still am around those people. But it was able, just seeing the good and leaving the bad, just taking the good from things and leaving the bad. And, I'm happy for that. I'm glad that it didn't freak my parents out and they say, oh, no, you're a bad kid, because mm-hmm. you're listening to this heavy music and you're, you know, riding a skateboard. But they learned that how to teach me the truth and to pull the truth out of those things. And so I think that's really important. And that puts me to another question, too. You know, a lot of our culture's messages are communicated through the media. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a young nephew, and everywhere he goes, he's got an iPad. Everywhere he goes, there's a screen. So how do we, you know, as either, you know, parents, aunts, uncles, mentors, how do we monitor what our children are taking in and kind of just keep a gauge on what's happening with the media intake and you know, how do we help them to do the chew and spit method, if you will, with the media intake?
Well, first off, I think it really is important to limit amount of screen time, mainly because there's a documentary, I haven't been able to see it, but I've heard some of the conclusions from it, called Screenagers, kind of like taking teenagers. But and it's actually showing how too much screen time is changing the brain. And so that's something that I would encourage parents to maybe look into. I think it's really easy with the kind of demands that parents have on them right now. We don't live in a place in a society where many people can do the single income household. A lot of times you have two working parents and then you come home and you're trying to get the homework done and you're trying to get the house cleaned and the laundry done and the dishes done. And it's just easier to plop the kids in front of a screen. And I don't want to negate the fact that that is a really difficult situation to be in. But I do recommend to just be limiting screen time, because basically, I mean, golly, the kinds of stuff that's out there. So there's an organization, I can't remember, I think they're from Iowa. It might be the new drug. I can't remember which one it is. That's talking about porn industry people that actually get the syllabi from schools to find out what the kids are researching for projects. And then they will create a fake website under the guise of having that information that then has porn smuggled into it.
Wow.
So things like that, of just knowing that this is a place where predators are, that we can't think that this is, oh, it's simple, it's cartoons, it's this, it's that. This is where predators are.
Yeah.
And they are preying on our children's minds. They're preying on their what their eyes see, and they're desensitizing. That's the second thing, is I don't think we can underestimate the impact of desensitization with phrases like just follow your heart, which you see everywhere, or things like that's his truth, I'm living my truth, live your truth, you be you, love is love. All these kind of messages that are, oh, and of course, one of my favorite ones, you deserve. Okay. So it's like anything from golf clubs to a new bathroom, somehow you deserve it somehow. All these things, you can only hear it so many times before you start believing it. And you may not realize that you're believing it, and you may not realize that your kids are believing it.
Yeah.
I had a parent contact me where I'm trying to remember what her kid had said. It was something along the lines of, I think, truth. She's like, oh my gosh, we raised our daughter in the church, we raised her in Awana, we did this, we did that. And they're hearing their daughter actually spout back some of these lies that we specifically address in the Mama Bear book. And that is what got their attention of, oh my gosh, we need to nip this in the bud, we have to be proactive about this.
Right. Yeah. That's so good, so important. And you know, that was something I talk about, these websites, even trying to find students. I mean, this is crazy, but it's truth. It's out there. And people can research more into that. You can probably find more about that at your website. But one more question before I get you out of here.
Okay.
A lot of parents are trying to homeschool, because public school is right. I am a product of public school. I made it. I survived. What would you say to parents who are considering homeschooling? Is that a good option, or is there something better for them? What would you say to those parents?
Oh, golly. I think this is one of those areas that every family needs to decide for themselves, because I would consider homeschooling a luxury. It would be nice if it weren't, but it kind of is. And you have to have the type of personality that's really committed to that, and you have to have the kind of children that learn well in that way. That being said, my husband and I are very strong proponents of homeschooling. And I think especially now that we're starting to see legislation take over the kinds of things that they're required to learn. For example, I don't know if you followed the whole thing going on in Austin, Texas, about teaching kids as young as middle school about anal sex. and condoms and how to participate in that without damaging yourself by, physically as much, and how to get as much pleasure as possible. Some of the curriculum coming out in California is just straight up, I mean, it's a pedophile's dream to be able to teach this stuff. And having kids role play in front of you, like, oh my gosh, like, I don't know, there's a lot of crude things I could say about that. We're just going to say this is a pedophile's dream right now. This is the stuff that's going on. And parents, like, I think there was one lady I talked to that they sent a message home the day before they were doing this stuff, and they buried it deep in all the stuff. So the parents might not even see it. So they wouldn't even be alerted in time. So this kind of stuff is one of the reasons why I think we're going to see more and more of a resurgence, not only in homeschooling, but maybe like the co-ops or private schools, because at some point when your kids are being taught about things like this, at some point enough's enough. And you say, you know what, even though it's going to be difficult, we need to do what we got to do. We got to do what we got to do.
Yeah.
But still, I would say that nobody should look down on a family for sending their kids to public school, because you don't know what their life is like and if that's a possibility or if that's it's doable for them.
Right, right. Well, thank you, Hillary. Thank you for sharing all this wisdom. This has been good. It's going to be really helpful for parents out there and for anyone leading youth out there, whether they're parents or not. This is just really important to understand the next generation, how to communicate to them. And so I'm really excited about what you guys are doing. Before I let you go, is there anything you'd like to plug? Where can people find you at? Where can they find some of your articles and those things?
Yeah, I would say come on over to mamabearapologetics.com. Again, that's M-A-M-A, Bear Apologetics. We have blogs. We're doing a series right now in podcasts going through the new Richard Dawkins book that's aimed at kids. In addressing a lot of the issues there. And I would say we're also starting for the first time. We've never done any kind of fundraising for Mama Bear. And basically, we're at the point where we cannot handle keeping up with the pace we've been going this year without having some support from our Mama Bears and Papa Bears. So I just want to say, if you really like what we're doing and you appreciate it, then please make it to where everyone's not working on a volunteer basis, because I do work almost probably 50 hours a week on this, and I don't really get paid for it. There's a lot of projects that we would like to do in the future. We would like to make the podcast more consistent, and whatever support you could give would be very much appreciated.
Absolutely, and it's a great cause to support, you know, saving young people, so I'm excited about that. Thanks for being with us, Hillary. This has been great, and we just enjoyed having you on.
Thank you so much.
All right. Just want to thank everyone who tuned in to our conversation with Hillary. Do us a favor. If you're on YouTube, go there and hit the red button that says subscribe. Become a subscriber today. That will help us out. Also, you can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So download and subscribe to our podcast as well. And we greatly appreciate all of your support. Thanks.
I thank God I finally made it out. I'm going for gold.
Go, go.
I'm going for gold.
Go, go, go.
They want my soul for gold. Tell them I never sign it. And I can get it on my own. I don't need your commas. Independent with my songs. Don't even.